Okay, thank you. All right. Okay, we're going to split this up. Of course, the format is interactive, as always here. Feel free to interrupt me in this small group. That's always possible. I'm going to talk a little bit about science journalism. What are science journalists doing? How has the field developed? Ending with some thoughts about or advice for you. If you run into a journalist, the phone rings and someone wants to talk to you, and some ideas about what you should keep in mind when that happens. Just a little bit about me. I work for Die Zeit, as Lars already said. It's a weekly paper in Germany, something that doesn't have a corresponding publication here in the US. 500,000 copies. We have a science section of 8 people, and Die Zeit is one of the few papers in the world that are have an increasing circulation and are doing fine so far. Can change every year, as you know from examples in the US. When I'm not working there, I write books on topics like mathematics, physics, music, babies, baby, urban legend. So I'm one of the guys who are like generalists who do a lot of different kinds of science. There's other colleagues who are very specialized on molecular biology or whatever. So whenever you talk to me, you have to keep that in mind. I need more explaining than other people. I want to go back and look at the history of science journalism. And the first thing I would call the cheerleader era. It started with magazines like Scientific American, which are still around, so this is not a something that stopped at some time. It's all of the three or four things that I'm talking about are still existing, but that was a dominant kind of science journalism. You have scientists that speak some arcane language that the public on the other side doesn't understand. And so you need a translator, and then the public knows what it's all about. And traditionally, that was the role of the science journalist. Take the arcane lingo of the scientists, turn them into plain English or German, whatever, and translate it. A lot of the time, this was done by scientists. You all know this guy and this guy. So you see, this still exists today. And in magazines like Scientific American, scientists write about their own science, but also journalists write about it. The second era I'm talking about is I call the watchdog era. That is maybe started in the 1960s, 70s. Problems with environmental pollution, with nuclear power. So society was having problems with what the scientists were doing, and the journalist was there in the middle, and had to not only report what science does, but also put this in a context in society, and maybe be critical, skeptical, and ask questions that the scientists might not have wanted to hear at that point. And that turned into the number three, what I call the journalist era. So a science journalist has a position towards a scientist, basically like a political journalist towards a politician. On the one hand, you talk about the great things they're doing, but it should be more. You are responsible to your audience. That's the people you are talking to and that listen to you. And then you have the scientists talking to you, but other people too. It's a network of many institutions and interest groups. I found an example about health communication in a book. And I translated it, it was German, but here you see all these, when it's about health, you have all these groups that are somehow involved in the communication process. They talk to each other, and the journalist is just a little part in this, somewhere on the left side of the diagram. So when we're in the era before the internet, the situation was this, that the science journalist was looking at the public as his focus group. He received all this information from different sites, could open the door and let the information through, and if he didn't like it, he could close the door again. So we were like the gatekeeper of information about science for the public. This changed a lot 20 years ago when the internet came along. I remember I was at MIT at that time for in a journalist program, and one of our fellows came and said, hey, there's this great new thing. We all had internet access. We could Telnet, and we could Gopher, it was called, all these kind of things. And she said, hey, there's this great thing. They have pictures, and you can click, and then you go somewhere else. So the World Wide Web was invented. And that was a great thing for journalists. You have to imagine how we worked back then. I was a freelance writer sitting in Hamburg, Germany, writing about NASA, for example. I had a private fax machine, which was not something that was very expensive, but I could send a fax to NASA. They would send me information back. And then I even ordered a brochure. There was a report back then about the Challenger disaster. And I had this brochure in my hand, and I was probably one of 10 people in Germany who had that. And with the advent of the internet, suddenly there was a lot more information available for us for free. And we could basically, instead of traveling or making phone calls, we could get a lot of the information from the internet. And there were a couple of years where our readers didn't have the internet, only we had it. And that was, of course, very good. But then what happened, of course, is that this wall burned down, and suddenly all these other guys could talk directly to the public. And that's what we have today. And with the advent of Web 2.0, suddenly even the public could talk back to them. And now we have this very complicated situation where the journalist is just one of many people in a network of communication that goes back and forth and doesn't have only one direction. And if we talk about publications, we get a new continuum between science and journalism. You have a scientist on the one side, so there are blogging scientists, and there are professional bloggers, and on the right side you have the traditional journalists, and someone might start out as a scientist, write a blog, and find themselves somewhere on this line. I don't know where you position yourself, if you do anything for the public, or if you just do your research, but it's been, there's shades of gray suddenly where there were two separate sides before. Of course, this has had consequences. If you look at the weekly science sections in US newspapers, there were 95 in 1989. They were 34 in 2005. And how many do you think are there today? It's wow. more than two. It's 19, but still. That's, of course, a decline, and many jobs have been lost, and the, yes?
Was 1989 the peak?
I would think so. I think the late 80s, early 90s were kind of the best time, especially in this country. In Europe, it's still a little different. It's not so drastic, but here with the new, especially the daily newspapers going down and in circulation and ads, it's a big problem. So people like us who publish a newspaper have to think about.
The other big issue is, to many, they've become health sections, not science sections.
Right. So
the New York Times is almost there. There's still some science writing, but it's 80% of the science section is actually health, or 70%.
Right. So
you know, on this report that was written here, whether they distinguish science from health.
I don't think so.
Also, the 19 may be an overcome, right? Because some newspapers just take the New York Times story.
Right, but it's about dedicated. I would assume at least they're different people. They might get the stories and get the story ideas.
The number of journal newspapers the same 1997-12.
I don't know how many newspapers there are. It's probably lower. Right, it's lower.
You mentioned before that the U.S. hasn't been going that well.
Right. Yeah. So, right. The number of outlets has gone down, and the number of jobs has gone down. And people like us. I mean, I said before we are doing well. The reason is we're a weekly paper, so we don't deliver science news.
You
I think every scientist gets their news not from the newspaper, but from the internet. And so the old media, like us, have to think about what can we provide that people don't get every day on the internet. And there are things like don't bring the news, but explain the news. So once a week, we give them some background stories on things that have happened. Bring surprising stories. Give them some orientation about what's important and what's not so important. Tell stories in the way that you go have a narrative in this, and not only the results that you present them. Act in the reader's interest. So look at what's really important for them. That's maybe why they do more health stories, because they think, okay, health is something that everybody is interested in, and maybe not the Higgs boson if it's just a news about how the world works. Be an expert, but keep the distance to the scientists and to the stuff you're writing about. That's included in what I said before. So what's the relationship between science and journalists in this journalistic age? It's just a couple of things that come to my mind. So what I said before, the journalist is not the scientist's interpreter, especially since the scientist can go public himself and voice his own stuff. A vast part of what is happening in science is too complicated to be explained in general interest media. I'm a mathematician by training, and I always, especially when I pick out math stories for a paper, I have to say, if I can't even tell what the question is, then I'm not talking about the answer, but if the problem cannot be formulated in plain German or English, then it's hard. Scientists have to be able to speak for themselves and address the public in plain language. That's the stuff about blogging and about talking to the public.
Could I interrupt and ask a question?
Yeah.
There have been several mathematicians who have made attempts, right? In fact, in the New York Times also. How successful do you think those attempts are?
There's always things you can, and I love reading about math, and I admire everybody who even takes a complicated thing like, for example, Simon Singh's book, the Fermat's Last Theorem, was a great piece of writing about a problem that you can state in plain language. It's easy to formulate. Of course, you can't tell how it's been proven, but there's a whole story of 300 years of mathematics behind it, and he did a great job in doing that. So you can do that, but there are theorems in modern math, like if the last four Fields medalists, there were two of them, or one or two of them, even if you tried very hard, it was very hard to convey the meaning of the theorems that they proved, I would say. But right, if someone does it, it's great. Journalism is not knowledge transfer, so it's not primarily telling what happened in science. And we are not educational institutions. We have to, of course, education is always part of what we do, but it's not the what we're there for. The job of science journalists is not just to present the audience with the wonders of scientific progress. I think that's become clear too. We define the topics, not the scientists. So you have a certain rank of things that you find important in your science. We might pick things for our stories that we might just have the list the other way around because we see an interesting aspect of a story that we think we can convey to our readers. A big part of what you do, I'm sorry, but is not so relevant for everyday life, and so we have to pass on that probably. The exceptions to this rule are the subject of our reporting. And we have scientific and non-scientific criteria for choosing their topics. There might be just an interesting person whose biography is interesting, who also does science. Whereas for a scientific journal, it's pretty clear what the criteria are, purely scientific. Science journalists are correspondents in a foreign country called science. See it a bit like that, like someone goes to France and reports on French politics for the US. There's certain parts of French politics that he finds interesting, whereas the French have have different priorities and a different list. And we are dependent on local guides, and that's you, the scientist. And one quote that's not to be taken too seriously, Victor Cohn was a medical reporter who died 14 years ago. Scientists are to journalists what lab rats are to scientists. especially in the brain science seminar that I've been sitting in now for the last 3 weeks, all these rats that you sent through your mazes. So, yeah, I hope you don't take that too seriously. Okay, there's always the danger of misunderstandings. We have different cultures. Just look at the people who work in the media and look at the people who do science. We play different roles. We speak different languages. That's clear too. And we have different criteria for quality, for what makes a good story, and what's good reporting or maybe not so good reporting. But the surprise, after I've told you all these differences, surprisingly enough, in some surveys, both sides, journalists and scientists, report predominantly positive experiences. I picked out one study that was in Germany on climate change. I think it would be a very different result in the US. But in Germany, the 78% of the scientists and over 90% of the journalists call their experience predominantly good. So the scientists don't feel misrepresented in the public, and the journalists don't complain about the scientists. As I said, it might be different here because the publications about climate change have been a bit different in the US. So if they see this encounter that they have professionally and they accept their different interests and roles, then it can work well. And there seems to be some compatible ideas about how to talk to the public. How much time do I have? Not so much anymore, right? So let me quickly, I'll pass on these. It's just that I try to list what roles the scientists and the journalists play in this communication. It's important to see that the scientist is not only the guy who tells about the great stuff he found out. He's also an advocate for even public policy, because like if you're a climate scientist and you find out something's going very bad, so you have to be an advocate for certain things. And he's always a lobbyist for his own good, especially in a competitive situation like American universities and research institutions, where it's important to be in the news, to get funding, and to be visible. And the journalist doesn't know everything, but knows who to ask, his reader's advocate. In an interview situation, we steer the conversation. We ask the questions. It's not your job. You can help us, but it's not your job to steer it. And we're in the best case, we're your partner. Skipping that, I come to that last thing. When the phone rings. What do you do when the phone rings and you just had a Nature article out, and if you have Nature or Science, you can be sure there will be journalists who call you and want to know something about it. The first thing is, when you have a phone like that, better stop, talk to your boss and get a new one. But of course there are fears, especially if you have don't have enough a lot of experience of talking to the media. Question is, will she, the journalist, understand really what my science is about? And will she turn my words around somehow if I explain something? Will she misrepresent what I'm doing or exaggerate it? Scientists are very modest people, and they're always afraid that something is exaggerated and called ground changing when it isn't. And will she really explain all the details? She won't. That's something I can tell you. So, ending with some tips about how you yourself behave in that situation. First of all, stay calm. You know more than the other guy. That's always important to know. It's about your science, so you're competent and you know what it's all about and what the results are. Be clear about who is calling you. First of all, what publication is it? Is it a tabloid or is it a TV show? Is it a radio station? So that determines how detailed you can talk about stuff. And also know, maybe you should know something about the person who's calling you. How much do they know? What level of language do you have to pick to talk to them? Adjust your level of science lingo, right? If you know the other guy has studied the physics or mathematics or whatever, you can certainly use some terms. Otherwise, if in doubt, go one level lower to make sure the other person understands what you're talking about. Einstein said you should say things as simply as possible, but not simpler. So simplify, be happy to simplify your own research, but don't oversimplify. And tell your story. In a scientific journal, you use very dry language and you talk about the results. Journalists love stories that have a beginning and an ending and have a climax and a happy ending, hopefully. Be personal. Talk about what it does to you to have an article in Science. I mean, you don't have that every 4 weeks. So it's use the word I and say, tell them how happy you are about it. They will love to include that in their story. Then the problem comes, okay, now you've done your interview and this person is going to write something and print it in a paper and you have no control over it. And I can't help you with that. That's the fact. You're not controlling what is being printed. So offer to verify your quotes. I think every good journalist will offer you that if they quote you literally, verbally, then you can check if you really want to say it in these words or not. And tell them really if they have any question, they don't understand something, come back and talk to me. But don't ask to see the finished article. I'm sorry, but we don't do that. In scientific or journals, they might do it. And in science, it's a good practice to cross-check. In journalism, that's not the custom. It might be a case if it's a very factual little piece and they want to get the facts straight. If it's a profile of your personality or something, the journalist is not going to show you what he thinks, what a kind of person you are. And wrong stuff gets printed, bad stories get printed, and there's another paper next week. That's the only comfort I can offer. But if you mind all the other things that I've told you, maybe you can minimize the danger of you being misrepresented in the public. Okay, thank you very much. Shall we do all the questions in the end? And you just do your presentation, or is there something?
I think it's better just to see if there's more questions.
Yeah. Something, maybe you can contribute some experience that you had. I would be happy to hear that. Okay, then let it sink and you
percolate.
And you, we have to switch microphones.
We have the techies.
So I just want to thank, first of all, the Kavli Institute, Kavli leadership, Fred Kavli too, if I could, because it's a very rare thing for someone like me, in particular a freelancer, to have what amounts to a sabbatical. Most of you work for various institutions. You work 6-7 years, and they throw you a big treat every now and again, which is to have a sabbatical, get rejuvenated, commune with those who you normally don't. So this is just a tremendous opportunity for me to do that. So I just want to start with that. Thank you. And I also want to thank Christoph, because that was a terrific, I think, history of science journalism, and also just a kind of set of entry tips to help all of us kind of work together in something that I'm going to talk about as well, which is telling what I believe is the greatest story ever told, which is sort of the scientific story of the universe from its largest scales to its tiniest scales, and what's unfolded throughout 14 billion years of history. Now, it's a tough audience, I have found, so I'm going to ask for a consensus. Can we agree there is something instead of nothing? Hopefully we can. I'm coming way back to a kind of contextual point that you normally don't get in the talks here. Normally, you're in programs here where you're among your highly sort of almost hyper-specialist groups, and so you drill right in to the details, way in the deep in the center of the earth. I'm just going to pull back all the way in the other direction. So if there is something instead of nothing, this does raise a few questions. Things like, how did the universe get here? And in fact, these are questions that are asked right here in this building, and attempts to answer them are made all the time. What's in the universe? How did those things get here, including things like active particles and neurons and grid cells? Why are those things the way they are? What's everything made of? How did we get here? What is our place? What will come of us in the universe? What can we really know about the universe? And in fact, this is sort of a question of epistemology, and it's interesting to see in some of your talks how you really get into arguments about really how does evidence relate to the theories that you're bringing up, and what does the evidence really give you license to say about, say, how cells work or how active matter works. What should we do and how should we behave? So this is getting into stories like Christoph was talking about, the science, technology, and society nexus. So this is things where science actually matters, science and technology. Those are all technology, as we know, is double-sided. So even something like CFCs, which were wonder chemicals in the 1930s, they were replacing lethal refrigerants when they start making them in thousands of tons and let them vent into the atmosphere over decades. They become sort of the major chemo villain one of the major chemo villains of the time. So that question leads to specific kinds of stories like that. And then, of course, the most important one, which is, what is the average airspeed of an African swallow? So if anybody is a Monty Python fan, they know where that comes from. Okay, so, but I also want to give you some sense of why I think telling science stories is important, why maybe we have to do it, and hopefully work together doing it. So the scientific way of asking and answering such questions, the ones that were on the previous slide, you know, it's proven fantastically illuminating and empowering. I think it's not a stretch to say that science has been a driver of culture. Science, even in its modern form, lasts 500 years, but I would argue that science in an earlier form, really more in technology and arts and crafts and in the innovation in materials, has been driving culture for thousands of years. That's why we have names like the Bronze Age and Iron Age. You know, then 500 years ago, we have something that we would recognize as modern science. And these have certainly been driving culture throughout. So the story of science is packed with high human drama. All of you probably have your own that you know about, and I would love to hear about them. In fact, Christoph's and my doors are open, way at the end of the hallway here. So come in and tell us your stories, dramatic or otherwise. We all love to hear good stories. We like to go out, go to the bar, and hear what's happened today. What did you discover in the lab? What kind of bad behavior did you notice from your colleagues and supervisors, your PIs? Sorry. And so, because of these three premises, scientists and journalists often find themselves in collaborative efforts of storytelling. By the way, this is just a wonderful, historic lithograph of Tycho Brahe taking measurements of planetary motion to unprecedented detail, and it's that data set that Kepler was then able to use to discern that the planetary motions were elliptical and not in that perfect Aristotelian circular pattern. So it's it was kind of a momentous data set for all of us. And then I'm going to just float one very personal driver for me. And this is, I think that the greatest gift that science really has to give to all of us is an invitation to experience awe. So in other words, I kind of look at scientific discovery as a form of revelation, I'll use the word, about how nature works. When we uncover that, when you uncover that, it is incredibly uplifting. And so, I mean, in some ways I've called myself over the years an oh wow science writer, because I love it when I can share with readers some uncovering of how nature works. From you'll recognize that just some of these falsely colored all the way from the subatomic level as that sort of particle dynamic shows to the image below, which is in some sense a portrait of the universe as looking at the differences in the energy of the cosmic background radiation from the earliest times. So Christoph was talking about, you know, how can scientists and journalists get beyond, in a sense, this head-butting model of communication and really start to work together, you know, so that it's more like that. We see Aristotle and Plato in a very collegial kind of attitude with one another. And so this is really how we should all try to work together to tell the greatest story that can be told. And how do you get from the headbutting model to that partnership model? I ended up putting three things down here, but as I was thinking about this even more, I think they actually all collapse into that very first one, which is adopt the other's point of view. If you do any kind of conflict resolution or couples therapy or anything where communications is an issue, that's pretty much what you're going to learn. Adopt the other's point of view. So in particular, when it comes to, say, the task of telling stories about science and maybe about mathematical science, theoretical physics, things which are inherently harder to bridge from the practice of those things to actually telling stories to the public. One of the key ways to get into the other's point of view is to remember what it was like when you didn't know what you know now. You have to, in a sense, do a kind of unlearning. And then finally, when it comes to the presentation of the story, it's a great idea to have this idea of be kind to the reader, listener, viewer. When I am an editor working with either professional writers or scientists, I try to use that maxim, be kind to the reader, because then what that does is it turns it into a collaborative process where the reader is really the recipient. That's our target. That's who we're serving. We're not serving the writer or editor. You're not serving the scientist. We're actually together serving the reader. And I think it's a great attitude to have when you get into these situations of science communication. So I'm going to shift gears. There's three parts to this talk. The first part I just went through, which is why should we tell science stories? This is a section where I'm going to use myself a little bit as a case study. You know, who becomes a science writer? And the answer to that is many types of people, but in some ways, I think my story illustrates probably a good at least half of the story, half of the experiences of the science writers that I know. And then the third part of the talk will be just, in a sense, trying to provoke you into thinking about ways that you can participate in the science communication world. So my early interests, even in high school, were the periodic table of the chemical elements, and the reason why that fascinated me so much is because if you look at that not-so-pretty chart, it is an amazingly efficient way of portraying everything that ever was, is, or will be. Every substantial thing that ever was, is, or will be. To me, that is actually an awesome thought. And then the brain, right? The brain. What interests me about the brain is that this is the seat of the mind. So the brain-mind problem was very interesting to me. I put these two together. I said, I should become a neurochemist. And I think this was misguided, but I thought perhaps by studying the chemistry of the brain, I would begin to have some handle on how to look at that question of how the brain and mind relate. As it turns out, I ended up really drilling in and generating data like I've been seeing at some of the talks here today. So it's been really kind of thrilling. This is not my data, but I did do cytoskeletal research. I was looking at, I'm going to even throw multisyllabics at you right now. A glial fibrillary acidic protein was something that I was looking at in Vimentin. These were in glial cells, which are support cells. That's actually an antiquated way of thinking of them, but there's more glial cells than neurons in the brain. And what came out of this, what my particular work, this was as an undergraduate, were gorgeous pictures of cells. In the end, I'll tell you why in a later, the pictures became more influential in my professional story than the science. But this was my early research experience. And this is where the double beheading comes in as a major deflection. So catalyst number one and two, I ran out of my glial cells one day, and I went to the supervisor and I said, I'm out of my petri dishes, what do I do? So he said, come on in early the next day. Two rats were in a cage. On the lab bench was an instrument that looked like this. There was a blade, V-shaped blade that way, a V-shaped blade that way, a handle that sort of looked like the one you'll see on a paper cutter. And I learned that day where glial cells come from. It was a very important lesson for me. I do not have moral issues with the use of animals in research as long as they're used responsibly and as long as we can defensively say that in the end there's going to be a greater good from the use of those animals than the sacrifice of their lives. So it wasn't a moral issue, but I realized at that time that that could not be part of my professional context. Just couldn't do it. And so that scared me out of lab work, and sometimes I regret that, sometimes I think that's fine. But I wanted to stay close to science and not get my hands dirty, so I ended up going into a field called history and philosophy of science. This was at Indiana University, so the idea is here, oh, you know, you don't get your hands dirty, but you really begin to look at a huge corpus of research, you know, over entire fields, over long periods of time, and you try to, you know, try to sort of trace out the larger stories and messages that science is telling us. But then there was another catalyst that came in, which is partly it's sort of a problem that I have with attention span, but partly it also had to do with sort of a kind of disinterest in spending more time pleasing professors than pursuing things that I found interesting. And so the grad school environment didn't look like a good bet, at least for me at that time. And at the same time, I ended up having a catalytic experience with a transformative professor. Hopefully we've all had this experience, or maybe some of you are the ones who transform others. But I was able to learn through my master journalism professor, Holly Stocking, that you can really take words, which and I have love for words, and you can take a love for science, put them together into a field called science journalism. That led to my first publication in a South Central Indiana newspaper called the Herald Telephone, but known locally as the Horrible Terrible. I also published in the Indiana Daily Student. These were my first articles. I used these as tickets into the profession, at least back then, when the gatekeeper was still there, were clips. Literally clips. You cut these things out and you send them to other editors. Other editors think, well, hey, some other editor took the risk. I will. You can, you know, you keep getting assignments that way. And that led me to Washington, D.C., where I ended up getting involved in a couple of publications that then really helped me out professionally because these were now well-known venues, nationally distributed clips. So I was in the club, got in the club. And this was in that golden era of journalism when you could find science stories everywhere, every major newspaper, as well as publications like these. I had an interest in not only writing for the choir, but really for the general public, for my neighbors, So I ended up writing for the Washington Post, which is my local paper in Washington, D.C., but also getting into venues like this, including Time and Fortune, which were some of the biggest, sort of most thrilling placements for me, because I knew I was really sending out sort of my oh wow stories in a way to much larger audiences. I got to a point though where, and I was covering things like chemistry, material science. These are fields where you actually can end up each week finding a new subspecialty within that field, find something interesting, write about it. Next week you're onto something else. But I felt that there were larger themes that collectively these groups were tying all these groups together. First book stuff, the materials the world has made. It's really an historical approach to figuring out how humanity has learned to transform the raw stuff of the earth into the constructed landscape. But the point of that, it was I wanted to get into this long form of writing books as a way of really synthesizing a vast amount of research and technology trends. Those are just some of the other books I've done. I have a copy of Supervision. Would love to share that with anybody who wants to come to the office, 1204. I diversified into some of the other traditional venues at that time in media. So one of them, radio and NPR, had a couple of wonderful stints working on the science desk of NPR. Ended up having an interesting experience writing a script for Bill Nye the Science Guy for a series that the Science Channel of Discovery did. So mostly a print guy, but dabbling in broadcast as well. But this also got me thinking that there are other ways of communicating, not just these traditional through these traditional channels. And this is something that has been foisted upon us all because of the deconstruction in a way of what the internet and the World Wide Web has done to journalism and communication in general. And Christoph really talked about this in his presentation just now. So this is really kind of broken down the structure. It's like everybody now has keys to the publisher's office, as Christoph was saying. And so these are just a couple of, actually some of the more interesting examples. I recommend all of you, this is the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics. It's actually quite a terrific blog here from Quarks to Quasars, publishing several really provocative and pretty well done pieces every day. So what are these other channels of communication? And this is where I kind of invite all of you to think about what you're doing and where some of that might map onto some of these channels, either on your own or with assistance with professional writers and communicators. So these are just some examples of science and literature, both fiction and nonfiction. I'm going to zip through so we can have some time for questions. But we also see it in movies. I recommend an old film, I think it's 1940, The Man in the White Suit, if only so you can hear the sound effect of the chemical synthesis machinery. It's just one of the greatest sounds you're ever going to hear in cinema, so I recommend that highly. There's a few other examples there. You can argue about the accuracy of the science that you see on TV, but it is really infiltrating that medium more and more as well. A couple of examples. I've been quite intrigued in the way science and art have been finding connections, so I'm going to just roll through a couple of examples there as well. When I was at Chemical and Engineering News, I ended up finding out about an artist in Virginia, Rebecca Kamen, who is smitten with the periodic table in a different way than I am, but certainly smitten. And she ended up looking at some spectral data in taking great liberties and creating these sort of sculptural representations of all of the elements, arranging them, according to the Fibonacci series in this particular example. But this also included sound, and there was even a performance element to it when it was open. So here's an example of a multimedia artist thinking a lot about the fundamentals of chemistry and bringing them into venues that really reached out to a lot of others that might not have access to this sort of thing, including students of dance who came in and performed along with the presentation of the sculptures. Another example, just a painter who had a very personal experience donating tissue to save the life of her sister. As a result, she had all kinds of dialogues with doctors and where she learned all about, you know, certainly this molecular motif, which we all recognize, and at least the sort of globular form in here, all about cells, put those together into really an incredible series, beautiful, of these helical paintings. Photographers also, here's a case of a photographer learning how to use an electron microscope, working with a nanoscience guy at Georgia Tech, does solid state science, and what you end up with are Ansel Adam-like portraits of nanoscapes. And these were blown up in huge ways. And just walk around, you know, Kavli, and you'll see art all over the place. So certainly Kavli is expressing this strong connection. Even dance, a choreographer who is local to where I live in Maryland, Liz Lerman, has been having all kinds of dialogues with scientists, genomic scientists first, but then physicists. She ended up putting together a performance called The Matter of Origins, which I became part of. The first act was somewhat traditional in that you had dancers and performers on a stage. This was really an investigation about the double edge of nuclear technology at Los Alamos and during the Manhattan Project. And so there was this very interpretive first act, but that was followed, I think, in an incredibly innovative way with a second act where, if you imagine all of us in here as the audience in that first act, we are told, walk out, go into the courtyard here, sit around tables like banquet tables, and at each table there was what she called a provocateur. And I was one of those. And then what happened around each table then was a discussion about what happened in the first act and about people's relationship to technology. So it started with the discussion of that you know, sort of world-transforming time in the 1940s, but then moving forward into how science and technology relate to us in our present lives. Tremendously rewarding experience for everyone. And physicists in the University of Maryland who were part of this danced. They were part of it. So, you know, you might end up finding yourself dancing. Poetry is another example. So here is one of my favorite many time sources, Roald Hoffman at Cornell University. So, you know, he got his Nobel Prize for work in bonding theory and theoretical chemistry, but he also is strongly moved to communicate via both poetry, and he's also a playwright. So those are additional channels of communication. I'm getting toward the end now. I've also been very interested in bringing in a live element, just like theater in a way. I was very inspired by the Liz Lerman experience. But the live element of science communication. So there is a channel called Science Cafe, which actually had its beginnings, I believe, in England. And this was at a time when there were the food safety scares, mad cow disease. And there was a concern by agricultural scientists at that time that the government was not communicating candidly and accurately with the public. So the ag scientists said, we're going to go straight to the public with beers in our hand. And they went to the pubs and started this whole kind of interaction called the Science Cafe. I think that moved into France as well. And now I have adopted that by running a series in DC called DC Science Cafe. Again, tremendously rewarding experience. We're bringing scientists and the public together in the case in DC, a very cultural hub of the city itself. We don't meet in cathedrals of science like this or in science departments, but really in pubs, in cafes, where the public goes. And so it's a rare opportunity for the public to have that kind of experience interacting with scientists. These are just some examples of some of the events we've had. This is Steve Ralston, whose name probably some of you guys know. He's local to me, and here's another example, just to show you that it's not just physics there. Really cover everything, including, in this case, the microbiome and its role in health and disease. But we've also had science-themed poetry events. We've had artists come in. So it really is trying to realize this idea that science is part of culture and not apart from it. And I surely am not the only one that does it. This is a map of an old one now of science cafes around the country. So you can actually find these pretty much anywhere you go. In fact, you can experience one on this coming Monday that the Museum of Natural History will be running at Dargan's downtown. It's called Science Pub. As Lars said, if all goes well, we're going to work together to run a a Kavli Science Cafe at SoHo. April 2nd is the date, so I hope all of you mark that down. Love to see you there. And it's not just the US, you know, the history, as I said, it started in Europe, but this is a very low resolution image, but you really can find cafes all around the world. So I'm just going to end with this idea that that there are many, many channels of science communication to explore. There's the traditional ones, and that is plenty for anybody, but there also are these other ones that will force you to find interdisciplinarity within yourselves, but it also might make you walk across campus and start interacting with some of your colleagues in other departments. So thanks for your attention.
At what point would following a good story and trying to get it out to the public become an investigation and then you decide that there's more going on than the original thought?
Chris, do you want to start that?
Yeah. Okay, then we're coming to the point where it's not about just the scientific results, but also about scientific integrity, about things like what are consequences for society. Mm-hmm. I mean, scientific integrity, for example, is now in the times of the internet done by scientists a lot, right? So if there's a questionable publication that where they think, you know, the statistics have been cooked or something, it's probably in most cases not the journalists that find the bad guys, but the colleagues and the peers, right? So the job for the journalist is to get, you know, early notice of that and follow up the story and write it up to have a great story, right? But investigative reporting in science for a journalist is a lot harder than let's say in politics, because you know, when I look at a scientific article, it's very hard for me to see the flaws and what might be wrong with it. I think it's more a job for the scientific community to be self-cleaning in a way, and then we're happy to write up the story.
So just an example does come to mind. You can give me some time to think, because I have nothing to say before. But in the pharmaceutical industry, for example, I do actually have an investigative journalist friend in Washington who was really finding out that in their sort of communications and leadership areas, that they were kind of propping up certain scientists out there to publish things in legitimate places. It seems peer-reviewed, but really it's all your puppets, you know, for the message that the pharmaceutical companies want to get out. And so, you know, that, if you run into that, and you're in a position something like the Zeit or Washington Post, you really, it's your responsibility to run with it, you know, to dig in and really get that story out.
I wonder about comparison, you know, kind of this interest of public to science in, say, in the US and in Europe. I don't know, my personal observation was, for example, when I was in CERN for half a year, was that there it was much more pronounced, I mean, this public interest to what people in CERN are doing, but maybe it's just I'm wrong. So what is your impression about comparison?
Wait, so I'm going to ask you to restate it's a question about
public interest. Public to the science, I mean, general public, how much people are interested in learning something about science.
So, Christoph, I guess I'll start and you can. But I mean, one measure of that is the slide that Christoph showed, you know, where the major science sections have been decreasing, you know, pretty dramatically since 1989. We're down to 19. Of those, so that is some sign that public interest has gone down. On the other hand, what the internet has done, you know, is this sort of idea that everybody has the keys to the publisher's office. There's way more science writing and communication out there than there ever has been, right? But people now can, in fact, when I look at some websites of some of the people participating in the programs here, I realized that that is a new, that's another channel of communication. I mean, some of these have become almost like blogs, right? And there's a lot of, some people are paying a lot of attention to their websites. So,
but what I meant, let's say, I'm meeting people at the street, say, they're in Geneva, and everybody knows about CERN and what's going on, okay?
It's local news.
Right? No. It's people who are not just in Geneva as well. I mean, okay, but I'm not sure. But my personal impression was that people are indeed kind of, a lot of people are interested there.
I mean, do you know whether people are interested in? You know what the editors want, and you know what sells advertisements, but do you know what the people want, and what the people are interested in?
Well, one of my colleagues works for NPR, a guy named Joe Palka. His view is, if you took all science writing out of newspapers and sort of major media, not many people actually would notice. I actually think that there's a kind of general interest out there. I mean, I don't know what your experience is out there, but you know, when you're around your Thanksgiving tables, your family's over, you have friends over. Let me ask you that. I mean, are your neighbors interested in what you're doing? or do you choose to not talk about that when you're just having a gathering of neighbors?
Nobody's interested. This is an extremely anti-intellectual country.
I don't know.
Like I think Lars is very interested.
No, but I mean outside of our profession.
Well, that's maybe I can add to this too. So there's what's like.
I'm just gonna say that there's a Facebook page, probably a lot of you know of it, but I believe in love science. But it has a lot of followers,
Right.
And it's just that people go online. I've generally found people have been really interested in what I do.
Yeah.
At first, I think it's novel that there are women in physics at all. But
as a newspaper journalist, I can add in the past we couldn't trace single articles to see what people read, and I think it's a good thing too, because sometimes we have to have stuff that's for a minority, but it's important. Ever since we went online, and a lot of our articles are online, you can see, you know, the clicks, you can see how many people read the first page but don't read the second, so then you learn a lot about how your stories work. And I can say that, for example, if I write about mathematics, I get a lot of clicks, because you just have to do something like the greatest puzzle solved or something. You have to have some keywords in the headline, and then it works, because these, you know, puzzles, solving puzzles is some archaic thing that we have inside of us. But so in the US you have this frightening thing about maybe evolution and climate change denial or whatever. Then in Europe you have people, the whole alternative medicine thing, which is very big, so you think, are people crazy doing this stuff? So, people who are real scientific thinkers are always a minority in all cultures, I think. But
On British television specifically, currently we have a figure who's as big as Carl Sagan ever was, who's called Brian Cox. I mean, and he's hugely popular in Britain and makes frequent TV programs. I don't perceive an equivalent figure here at the moment.
Well, I think, I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson's probably on his way to becoming that.
Who's sorry?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, okay.
I think part of the difference is that we don't have public television.
Well, Brian.
I think that is the complete absence of public television that means you just don't see it on TV.
Well, you have TV. You do have TV, yes. People don't watch it.
I think it's terrible. You should like BBC.
No, maybe not.
Another figure I read today was people can take the volume of reporting about Britney Spears and it's more than all science and technology reporting taken together. That was very impressive. We're doing a minority program for a certain audience, but it's an important audience.
So we're stopping on a different topic. In your last slide, you advise people when you talk on the forum about your work, say, if you use the I did this, I did that, and so on. Now, I understand the need to make the story personal and to make the story effective. So, on the other hand, most work these days is collaborative. And first of all, it's kind of customary for us to give credit to others, and especially if the work is with a student or a young researcher, we try to say, well, that person really did all the work. So how to best balance these two?
Like there was a Nature article right now in January or February about an old star being discovered, very metal poor star, and so I wrote it about the main researcher was a German for the German news, and in Australia the guy who actually found the data was an Australian. Because people are interested in other people, but if you make it clear, I think you're right. You have to make clear that science is a team effort most of the time. Not in math, they have these lonely genes. But otherwise, as soon as you have telescopes and big machinery, it's always a team. As long as you have a paragraph in the article that makes that clear, I think it's okay to pick out single people because they're interesting.
Yeah, let me just add to that. So, you know, if you look at a PRL article from CERN or someplace like that, right? I mean, it's like 50, 100. I don't know what someone's probably come up with the record, but I think, you know, sometimes hundreds of names are on there.
Thousands,
right? Thousands. So this is a, you know, kind of an important issue about difference in a sense communications values, right? I mean, I noticed even all. I don't think a slide will ever go up. You know, with data that doesn't have down here, really it's the specific reference, and I think that's a terrific thing. But when we write about stories, let's say it's based on a paper and there's 10 authors in it, I mean, just imagine yourself reading a newspaper article where two or three chapters is nothing but, and the authors are, and an editor would never accept it for one thing, so even if we were so inclined as writers to do it, it wouldn't get through the editorial process. And so we have to find ways that sort of work for everybody to acknowledge that it's a team effort. But in the end, to tell a story, we do kind of have to zero in on a protagonist or two and tell it in that way.
That's an extreme case also. You know, the example you gave, that's an extreme case.
Let's not go to the extreme case. I mean, just go through any issue of Science Magazine, Nature Magazine, all kinds of articles. Each one has five. I don't know what the average is, probably at least 3, 4, 5 names. And if it's that number, then sometimes you'll mention actually everybody. In addition to the PI, you know, here's who else worked. But it's always a balance.
All right, thanks for a great dialogue.
Our doors are open, and if you want to do some more one-on-one things, you can go to the next meeting.